Okay,
lovely. Recording again. So you said that you joined, once you'd started joining Bristol Crisis Service for Women, you'd got in touch with organisations and the founder members like Diane Harrison and Louise Pembroke of Survivors Speak Out.
Yeah, that's right. And then gradually I reached out to various sorts of organisations and groups and started talking to women. And I sort of, but a lot of the way that I contacted people was word of mouth, and a lot of women were really keen to take part in the research and really wanted to talk about how they felt that self-harm wasn't understood and how they felt that it wasn't well responded to. So they wanted to do something. They wanted to take part in something that was going to make a change. That's the main thing, I think, that I was saying.
Absolutely. And so how long did the training, sorry, not the training, the research phase of the project take?
Quite a few months, because it took time, I think, to contact organisations and individuals and to get people to want to take part and to communicate with them. A lot of it was done by post, but also I interviewed women in Bristol. I also talked to organisations about their work and their kind of approach to self-harm as a sort of, so there was like two strands to it. One was asking women themselves about self-harm, their own experience, and then also talking to organisations kind of separately about what they were doing. So it took several months. And lots of things came out. No, go on.
Which organisations were working with people that self-harmed?
There was a place at the Bethlehem Royal Hospital Crisis Recovery Unit that were doing some pioneering work, really good work. There was, obviously, there was Rape Crisis, Women's Aid, sexual abuse support organisations, women's centres. So they were, and they were Mind. So they were trying to find ways of working more positively and understanding. I mean, obviously places like mental health services and prisons and so on were working all the time with women who self-harm, but weren't necessarily thinking very much about how they were working. There were people like in the prison service, there was a psychologist at Holloway who was particularly interested in improving the understanding of women's self-harm. And there was, we did some work at Rampton Special Hospital in the end, so that there was also organisations like Women in Special Hospitals and Women in Prisons. So there was organisations all over the place who were trying to, who understood that self-harm was a big issue and that it wasn't being well responded to. And then there was a kind of, I suppose, often felt like the mainstream services often weren't very aware about it, apart from seeing it as a problem that they wished would go away.
And how did you contact the women who were using self-harm? Because obviously the helpline was anonymous at Bristol Crisis Service for Women, so you couldn't contact service units via that directly.
No, I think we did a lot of it through various sorts of organisations and groups. So we asked different, like whatever, Rape Crisis, sexual abuse services and so on, to pass on information to their service users and ask if they would like to be involved. And I think we also sometimes used to get a lot of women contacting us by post and asking for information and booklets and things. Well, it was leaflets at the time. So we used to send out, asking people when we sent things out, would you like to take part? But I think I felt to some extent that I wanted, I didn't particularly want to ask women who didn't have any sort of support in the world to take part in the research, because there'd be nothing for them, you know, if it upset them. So actually it was quite good to do it through like sexual abuse organisations and so on. Then subsequently, a group of women who I had interviewed in Bristol, well, a number of women who I'd interviewed in Bristol, had said that they wished there was some kind of magazine run by survivors of self-harm. So I and this group of young women set this up. I don't know if you've seen it. It was called Shout.
I spent yesterday morning reading back issues.
Oh, right. I see. I haven't got any anymore. That's another thing I'd love to see. And it's a little bit vague how we managed. Somehow people must have heard about things and got in touch, and because we had quite a big circulation of Shout. And I think we asked women to contact us and give us their views. And there was a lot of word of mouth, really. So in terms of the people to take part in the research, it wasn't difficult to find women that wanted to take part.
Did you write most of Shout? Who did the editorial? Because I was quite struck by its quite jokey almost tone, slightly sarcastic. I thought it was great.
Yes. I don't know if you're in touch with any of the women that, and I probably shouldn't say their names really. We used to come together, me and about three or four other women, who had wanted to set this up. We used to meet at the crisis service, and then subsequently we used to meet at the Basement Project and just write the stuff. But it mostly came from them, not me. Because I was sort of working as a professional, I didn't want to be the, even though I'd got my own experience of self-harm, I didn't want to be the one that said, you know, because it was very much about a survivors, self-harmers group. And then people used to send in, you know, letters, poems, little things, you know, so there used to be a lot of readers' contributions as well. But I think the slightly sarcastic, funny thing came from the women that in the group, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's lots of cartoons from that are signed by Louise Pembroke as well. Were they specially commissioned?
Oh, wow. I'd forgotten about that. How wonderful. She was, I know, I remember now, she was pretty keen on Shout. I think she was a little bit less keen on the crisis service itself. Not that she didn't think it was, did good work, but she, and I really understand this, she was very much into survivor-led stuff, the survivor's voice, not the voice of blimmin' professionals or, you know. So she was, you know, yeah, she really liked Shout. No, but I'd forgotten that she contributed those. It was brilliant.
I get a sense with Bristol Crisis Service for Women that it was survivor-led for at least kind of the first or so year, yeah. And then it kind of moved away from that.
Yes, that is, yeah, that's so, yeah. And I think I think some of the volunteers who, for the helpline volunteers, I haven't really mentioned, some of them had experienced the self-harm themselves, but probably quite a lot hadn't.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you, when you were being sort of inducted, that you'd gone through the training that helpline volunteers go through. What did you think of that, given that your professional experience before? What did you make of the training?
I thought it was great, actually. It was very good. It was mostly sort of experiential, in the sense that, I mean, there was some kind of information giving about self-harm, but a lot of it was pairing up with somebody and talking a lot about yourselves, and talking about your own feelings and issues and that. I can't remember the detail, but I remember thinking exciting and it was different and it was really good. That, and at the time, I mean, a lot of the counselling training I had done had been like that, that a lot of it was looking at yourself and your own feelings rather than kind of looking at them that are somehow ill and, you know, in trouble and different from me, who's all okay. It was much more sort of equalizing and opening people up. I loved it.
Did you ever do any helpline shifts? Did you ever?
Yes.
Or was it just the training?
No, I did. I think I did once a week. I probably didn't do once a week, but yeah, I did. It felt like it was really important part of the job was to be doing helpline shifts. And also we used to do a sort of supervision, you know, the day after people had done a shift, they would talk to somebody about how it had been and what they'd felt and all that. So I used to do that as well.
And you said you were 38 when you started at Bristol Crisis Service for Women. What was the kind of age range of people that you encountered when you were working there?
Do you mean volunteers or people that use the service?
Yeah, volunteers. Did you feel that you fitted in terms of age, or were there many generations volunteering there?
There were quite a lot of younger women, I think, but there were older ones. There were some women older than me and some around the same, but I think more probably younger women. And I think sometimes they wanted to, well, they were, it's partly about the stage of life when you're free to actually go out and be on a helpline till midnight and haven't got kids at home. And also maybe, you know, in their careers, they were sort of wanting to get that kind of experience. And I think a lot of the women that phoned the helpline were quite young as well, but not by any means all. You know, there were older women. And that was interesting because I think the image of people who self-harm was often, oh, it's young, it's kids, it's youngsters. And actually, of course, we found that there were lots of women that had been coping by self-harming for, 30 years or something.
That leads me on to one of my other questions is, was there in your research, was there anything in it that surprised you in your findings?
I suppose actually that was one of the things, just how long for some women self-harm had lasted. So it maybe started when they were children or teenagers and they were still using self-harm when they were in their 40s, 50s, 60s. And it did surprise me. And it made me very sad, I think, not at all because I thought, you awful person, but because I thought how kind of desperate that no one had helped for all that time. And that woman still felt so absolutely desperate. But then I realized that it was a way of coping. Sometimes, you know, a way of coping for a very long time, but that again, it seems wrong, you know, that somebody couldn't have the help that they needed to not need that for all that time.
Yeah. So, was the report that you eventually wrote, the report based on the interviews with and 76 yeah. women? Yeah. Did that come out after you'd held the Cutting Out the Pain conference or before?
I'm not sure. Probably before. Can't really remember. I know that I went kind of that phase of the job finished, the research part kind of pretty much finished, and then I was focusing a lot on training. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
So talking about that, when the report was published then, what impact did it have when it was published?
I think the impact was probably gradual because we probably should have done more to launch it as this great big thing and I think I might have been a bit sort of shy and not confident about saying to the world of psychiatry, look at this, take notice of this. I think nowadays I would, but there was a kind of sense that, oh, they might, people in the kind of mainstream psychiatric world will probably think it's not proper because it's been done by this little charity and so on. But I think what happened was it fed into the training we did and the information that we, you know, the books that I wrote and the information that we gave. And so it sort of filtered out into the world. And, you know, every time that I did training, I would refer to it and show the results of it. And people were interested, you know, and not just the sort of women's centres, rape crisis, those sort, but we did get kind of more and more psychiatric hospitals and prisons, as I've said, and youth services and so on, wanting to know about it.
Were you targeting your training at those sort of settings to try and influence their behaviour?
Yeah, but often it was that they came to us and asked for it. So I think the first place I ever went was social services in North Wales, and that was a bit nerve-wracking. I can't remember now whether we kind of approached organisations just out of the blue ourselves that we hadn't had any contact. We've got a kind of big database of organisations, but it was probably ones who had been in touch with us and asked for information. So subsequently, when I was working for the Basement Project, we used to much more just blanket send stuff out to social services and psychiatric services all over the place. But that was later.
Okay. So there wasn't as much publicity and sort of dissemination of the report as maybe you would have liked. Is that?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that was partly about lack of confidence, really. About the divide between psychiatry and psychiatric services and, you know, psychiatric professionals, medical professionals in particular, the divide between them and kind of community organisations and survivor-led organisations. I think the kind of, there was a more resistance amongst, like, for example, when we did do training in hospital settings, often nurses would come to the training, but doctors wouldn't. You could hardly ever get a doctor that would lower themselves. It felt as though they thought it was sort of beneath them and not proper. But I mean, I suspect that I, you know, maybe I should have been more pushy. I don't know. But if I was to do it again, I would much more strongly say, shut up and listen, instead of thinking to psychiatrists and instead of thinking that you're the, you've got the right to dominate the conversation, you know. But, and of course, that's what survivors groups were doing a lot. But having said all that, I think actually the work that we did at the crisis service and the crisis service, self-injury support they're called now, carried on to do. And then the work that we did through the Basement Project, I think it, you know, made a huge difference over the years to understanding of self-harm and attitudes, you know, but it's sort of taken time.
Absolutely. I will ask you more about the Basement Project later. I'm just chronologically working through things.
Yeah.
I mean, what seemed to me to be quite groundbreaking about the report was that you asked women who were self-harming why they were doing it and what help they needed.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be an approach that was quite rare, certainly amongst in psychiatric settings at the time, rather than,
yeah,
you know, seemed to be psychiatrists telling women why they were doing it rather than asking them why they were doing
and
it.
And telling them why they were doing it and also telling them that they had to stop it was the main thing. And sort of punishing them. I mean, I know it seems so self-evident that you should ask people why they're doing it and what they need. But, you know, often it was seen as, well, you've got to stop this. And so, and that talking about it is going to feed your, you know, giving you attention. Because, of course, they often saw it as attention seeking. So there was this kind of theory that giving you attention will only reinforce that bad behaviour. So yeah, it was groundbreaking, even though to a lot of people it seems such an obvious thing to do.
Do you think the, you know, psychiatrist's approach to it was because self-injury was seen as quite a gendered activity that women undertook, and so that affected how people responded to it?
Probably, yes. Because there were, yeah, and women being generally seen as more hysterical and more sort of unstable. And also, it was probably very shocking because women were mutilating bodies that are supposed to look beautiful. You know, so that are supposed to be, we're supposed to kind of please people by our appearance. So it probably horrified them that women were very much stepping outside of that kind of, you know, how you're supposed to look your best for the world and for men.
Absolutely. So,
I've run out of steam there.
The report. Yeah. You've done the research of the report and you've been doing lots of training. So there are also lots of leaflets that you wrote, is that right, for the project?
Yeah, there were leaflets already, which the crisis mm-hmm. service had already written before I got there, which used to be sent out, and which was brilliant because there wasn't much else of it, you know, that people could get hold of. But I suppose what I wrote then were more sort of substantial booklets, which I think are still there, or just updated versions of them.
And were they easy to write once you'd done the research?
Yes, yeah, they were, yeah. And for the ones that were to do with sort of self-help, I got input from like the women that were involved with Shout and so on. But yeah, they were actually, I loved doing them. And it felt like people really, really loved having them, you know, it's like there's a lot more around now. And there's, of course, the internet now, although not everything on the internet is good at all, but there's a lot more information but at the time, people were absolutely, you know, thirsting for, women were thirsting for information and supportive stuff that they could read for themselves. And I think, to be fair to professionals, a lot of those were also thirsting for some information to help them in their work. I mean, it's easy to kind of slag off mainstream services and psychiatry and so on. But I think actually there were a lot of people who wanted to understand and wanted to help better and realised that, you know, that they needed more information and understanding, and they wanted it. So yeah, it was really good and exciting.
Brilliant. I mean, you've gone on to write many books, both about self-harm and fiction. Had you done much writing? Well, you were 38 when you joined, so was writing part of your life before you joined Bristol Crisis Service for Women?
not really. I'd done an MA, so I'd done a research project about equal opportunities in local authority employment. So it wasn't exactly the same. I hadn't written fiction I hadn't done a lot, I suppose. I'd done some things to do with, run some women's days, and kind of written stuff that came out of those. And I'd been teaching women's studies, so I suppose writing stuff for that. But I hadn't really written much, no.
But Nothing.
Carry on.
I was going to say, what can you remember about the Cutting Out the Pain conference in September 1995? Because that seemed like quite a, important event as well.
Can we talk about that another time? Because I've got to get my head around it. It's just, I can't remember much at the moment. But as I've been thinking about the things you were going to ask me, a lot of things have come back. So we'll talk about that next time, perhaps, yeah?
Absolutely. I don't know whether you'll remember about this, but one thing I noticed from looking through the archives is that the kind of management structure of Bristol Crisis Service for Women changed while you were there. And you mentioned before that there wasn't a lot of management going on when you joined. And of course it was run as a collective, but that slightly changed when you were there. I wondered if you could remember anything about that.
Yeah, I think it mostly changed after I'd left, actually. Or perhaps it was beginning to, only just beginning to. I mean, it was kind of lovely, the idea that the collective thing, that everybody that's volunteers are part of the collective and we all run it. And we all discuss, but it's very hard for it to work in. I mean, I know that women's organisations did run like this, and maybe some managed better than we did, but it was kind of hard because we would have a monthly meeting to which quite a lot of the volunteers, the collective, would come, or maybe only a few would come, and Hillary and I would be there. But of course, Hillary and I were the ones that were working full time, day after day in the job, and the volunteers were maybe doing one shift on the helpline a fortnight or something, and they kind of got other jobs, and they weren't. So I kind of felt a lot of the time that it was me and Hillary telling them everything, and yet then expecting them to make decisions about. Yeah, so it was, there were one or two people that were more involved that did actually take more kind of management responsibility. There was a woman called Heather. I don't know if you've met Heather.
Was that Heather Watts?
Yes, I think so, yeah. And she and one or two others, I think, who were a bit older actually as well, felt, but again, they kind of didn't spend the time doing the work that we did. So it often felt like there wasn't really much management and Hillary and I were doing it. So, yeah, there was a thing, the phrase at the time, the tyranny of structurelessness, which the tyranny, and it was said about collectives that it's actually quite hard to manage an organisation like that. But I couldn't help being a bit sad that it was going to change and there was going to be a kind of hierarchy of management. But I can see why, because of the sort of efficiency of it and of role. You'd have meetings and we'd decide things and then everybody would go away. And it was like, who's actually going to do the things we've decided? Well, actually, it was me and Hillary. So, do you see what I mean? There wasn't somebody that had the role, the job of I don't know if there was a treasurer. I think Hillary did all that. So we hadn't got defined roles of someone. So we might make a decision. And then there wasn't somebody perhaps that had been tasked with that job. So it did really need to change and develop.
Absolutely. So Hillary presumably was coordinating the helpline as part of her role.
Yeah. And she was doing a lot of the kind of admin of the organisation, although I tended to help her with it. We used to do things like a lot of grant applications and all sorts of stuff like that. I used to help her, but that was, she was doing that. But yeah, she mostly, and she coordinated the training.
It must have been great, I imagine, for Hillary to have you join, because it kind of doubled the number of employees at the organisation. So it must have massively increased what you could achieve.
Yes, that's right. And also we could support each other, because, you know, it's, although it was fun and interesting, it was also quite painful quite often, the work, you know, and you're thinking about sad things quite a lot. And quite often people would phone, women would phone the office during the day, even though we tried to differentiate between the helpline. At the time, it was the same telephone number. There wasn't a separate telephone number for the helpline. So people, women could phone just during the day and want help. And, you know, so you were constantly kind of either just in your own head or in contact with people thinking about painful, sad stuff. So I could think, you know, having the two of us supporting each other and talking things through and having a laugh and having cups of tea and cakes was, yeah. So I don't know how it was for her after I left. We had had somebody part-time for a while called Tessa, but I don't know whether she can.
We haven't interviewed.
You haven't interviewed Tessa?
Sorry, we're going to interview. I haven't interviewed her yet, but she has agreed to.
Oh, right. Because, yes, she came, you know, I think I'd been there quite a while when she came, and she was quite fun and she was involved in it. And she also came with me to do some of the training. I think she probably came with me when we did the training at Rampton Special Hospital. So that was nice, having somebody else involved.
And did any of the other volunteers help you with any training? Were there any volunteers that did training?
No, there weren't. I wonder if perhaps we didn't even ever ask them if they wanted to, which is a bit of a shame. if I had it to do again, I think I would probably, you know, ask if people wanted to do that. It's, yeah, interesting. I think there was quite a sort of separation between, Not in a kind of status way, but in terms of roles between the helpline volunteers and what we were doing in the other things we were doing in the organisation.
I'm really interested by what you said about the support that you and Hillary were able to give you. What other ways did the organisation support you? Because it is tough stuff to listen to.
Yeah, we had the morning after you did the helpline, you would talk to somebody on the phone. A specified person would do a session with you, about an hour, talking through what you'd dealt with on the phone the night before. And sometimes, you know, some people were better than others at doing that. So Hillary and I both had external supervisors. I had a woman in Bristol, a psychologist or something. Her name was Deborah, but I can't remember much else. So I used to go to her maybe every couple of weeks, so I could talk about not just I could talk about organisational stuff and the work I was doing, as well as the kind of self-harm helpline stuff. The monthly meetings that were the kind of collective probably weren't very supportive because they were about trying to make decisions and organise things and so on.
Were there obvious tensions within the organisation, sort of flashpoints about issues or between generational differences or anything?
I don't think so. Not really. There were sometimes differences about certain sort of policies. For example, about how you were going to deal with abusive callers. I remember that being an issue, really. We had some, sadly, and rather unbelievably, we had some very, very abusive women that would phone. And I remember one issue being about, oh, we're going to sit here and be abused for an hour by this person, these people, or are we going to say no to that? And that I remember being quite upset about that and not really agreeing with the decision, and yet kind of respecting the reasons for it. But on the whole, no, I think there were good relationships, and we felt, but because the decision making was hard, probably it wasn't as good as it, you know, again, it was mostly me and Hillary that decided things. And I wonder if perhaps the volunteers ever felt, you know, excluded, or that they could have played more of a role, that, you know, perhaps. So I don't know really how they felt. And there would be quite a turnover, but that was often because of what was going on in people's lives. But if I had the time again, I think perhaps maybe there'd have been more sort of supportive meetings with volunteers, not just about, you know, the monthly admin thing, but about, you know, getting together to talk about the work and share stuff. Because it was lovely at the training courses. You had all that contact with them and talked loads, but then there wasn't a lot. You know, you'd see the volunteers when you did a shift on the helpline, so there'd be two other women there, but there wasn't much getting together. So I'm thinking, as I talk now, really, that perhaps we could have shared more and shared more support and shared more decision making.
Hillary mentioned to me that there was a time when the BCSW held women's discos in at the Folk House on Park Street. I don't know whether that was while you were there, but also occasionally Kaylee. So there wasn't any kind of, it wasn't like a social thing, working, volunteering there as well. People weren't going to the pub together, having that kind of contact.
No, not much. I think that perhaps some of the volunteers that had trained together, you know, when there was a particular training course, I think some of them might have probably did get together, but not so much with me and Hillary. But I'm vaguely remembering now a kind of sense that they had formed little groups that, I don't remember doing much socially. There might have been a kind of a party type thing at the crisis service, you know, drinks and nibbles thing or something. That sounds a bit posh, not as posh as that, but not much. But, you know, I was only there 2 years, so it had a lot of time before and after me.
And you wanted to stop round about after an hour, so we're coming up for that. So if I make this my last question now, unless you're... So I was just going to ask you about the office, because we've heard quite a lot of things about what the office was like. So what's your recollection of the environment of the office and how it was?
I don't know if it's still there, but... I liked it. It was above a shop, which was a feminist bookshop, green something. Anyway, Yeah, I really liked it. And it had nice big windows and was quite bright. And then there was a little room, which I'll talk to you about how I used that later, another time. But it was nice, but the horrible thing was going there at night, because when you went at night for the helpline, you couldn't go in the front door of the shop. You had to go round the back, which is a very, very dark yard with no lights, and really scary to walk down. And you had to go in a back door, and through these kind of horrible metal doors. And so I remember being frightened coming out at night. But for working there in the daytime, it was lovely.
And taxis, would they come right up to the door to pick you and volunteers up after helpline shifts?
I don't think they came around the back. I had a car, so I right. used to, if I oh. possibly could, I used to take the car around the back to the back door. But there was a business there, and the man that worked there was absolutely horrible. And if he saw you driving, for some reason, he would be really aggressive if you took your car down there. I suspect the taxis waited out. I'm not sure. You'd have to ask one of the volunteers about that used a taxi. I feel a bit bad about that thing. It's like we accepted it at the time. We said, oh, yeah, that's how it is, being really scared. And actually, it's appalling, really, that, you know.
I think there is something ironic about a charity like Bristol Crisis Service for Women being in an office that made so many people feel unsafe.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, possibly what happened was that volunteers would leave together so that they weren't on their own. But I've got a feeling that I would, you know, by the course arriving on your own, I definitely remember going out the back in the dark and being scared. But yeah, it is pretty ironic. I think we felt like we were kind of heroines, but it's mad. Yeah. Look, so should we do another session? Because it feels like there's so much.
Yes,
it feels lovely. Like there's a lot more to talk about. That's if you want me to talk about a lot more.
I would love for you to talk about a lot more. I'll stop recording now and we can plan another time to talk further.